you're listening to Spellbound.
Welcome to episode 21 of Spellbound. That's right, Spellbound is now officially legal drinking age, which is quite scary. Spellbound is now a CastBox original. You can still listen to it anywhere else you typically listen to podcasts, but check out CastBox today and see what's making it the fastest growing and highest rated podcast app for both iOS and Android. I'm joined today by Claire Lehman. Thanks for joining us today, Claire.
Yeah, sure.
You are the founder and editor-in-chief of Quillette, which is an awesome publication. I love all the subject matter you guys tackle. It's so different, so unique, so special. Would you mind sharing your journey which led you to start Quillette? You have such a fascinating story. I'd love people to hear it.
Well, I was a psychology graduate student back in 2015, and I became aware that what I knew to be the scientific consensus on a range of topics in the behavioral sciences weren't being reflected in the media, in Australian media or international media. And I just noticed that there was a gap where certain topics were not covered and not discussed. I think part of it is political correctness, but another part is just lack of knowledge, because most journalists don't train in the sciences, and particularly the behavioral sciences. So I just noticed that there was a gap. Certain topics were not being discussed for various reasons, and I saw an opportunity, so I grabbed it.
What kind of things were you seeing that were being misrepresented in the media?
Well, a topic that always kind of irked me and annoyed me was the way certain feminist issues were covered. So when discussing something like the gender pay gap, if you're trained in the social sciences and the behavioral sciences, you get it sort of drummed into you that a correlation is not causation, and any kind of social phenomena has many variables influencing it. It can't just be ascribed to one variable. So whenever I see conversations about gender disparities, for example, there's fewer women on corporate boards, and that is because of sexism, I get my hackles up, because as a trained social scientist, I know that it's never one variable. Sexism might be part of the equation, but there's going to be other things going on. And so it was this kind of simplistic presentation of these complex issues that was really irritating me. And I thought, well, it's time to do something about it. And I had a lot of academics and social scientists in my social network, and I asked them to contribute articles, and they did. And it's just gone from there.
Wow. So were those some of the original posts on Quillette?
One of the first ones we did, which was extremely popular, was an essay by Brian Boutwell, who's at St. Louis University. He's a criminologist, and he's an expert in twin studies. He wrote an article about how we assume that children's personalities are shaped by their parents, but he was explaining the data that comes from twin studies, which shows that there's a much larger genetic component that we don't fully appreciate. The field of behavioral genetics is relatively new, and it hasn't had much exposure in the media, I guess you would say, but it does turn a lot of previous assumptions that we had about human nature on their head. And one of the things that behavioral geneticists have found is that the home environment that we grow up in actually has much less of an impact on the traits we develop as adults than we previously thought. And the influences that seem to be most powerful are our genetics, but also our social circle growing up, our friends. Our friends seem to have more of an influence on us, on our personality development, than our parents, which is really counterintuitive and strange. Anyway, Brian wrote an article about this, and it just went viral. I mean, it was such a impactful essay, partly because it was really well written and partly because it's such a counterintuitive subject.
Yeah, and it's never, you never hear that side of the argument represented in arguments like this.
That's right, yeah. I mean, and it could be wrong. I mean, he's not saying that all of the science is settled and we know everything about these issues. It's obviously highly contested and complicated, but these are some sides of the argument that never really get airplay.
It's never one variable, especially with something like sexism or the gender pay gap. And what I love about what you're saying is that it's not that it's not that, but it's a lot more than that, because the common response you hear when people are talking, when they're getting up in arms over sexism and patriarchy and all this stuff, is you hear people on one of either side of the coin. They're either saying men are evil or women are evil, or, you know, men are out to get women or women are out to get men. And you never hear I feel like you never hear people saying it's a bunch of different things and we have to address all of them, or we're just going to kill each other.
Yeah, that's right. Of course, there's sexism and of course there is discriminatory treatment of women. But unless we also look at structural factors like access to childcare, flexible work arrangements for women who have babies, and until we take into account the fact that women might choose different things on average, that's a controversial statement to say that women choose different things. But the social science does suggest that women have, on average, more interest in people working in caring professions and more orientation towards things that give intrinsic rewards. So women tend to be less money hungry and status obsessed than men. And I personally think that's a good thing. And I don't think that if people are less status obsessed and money hungry, that somehow they should be thought of as inferior.
What do you think makes, I have my assumptions, but I'd just like to hear from you, since you're way more involved in this topic than I am.
Yeah.
What do you think makes statements like that controversial, that women are less status obsessed and money hungry and more nurturing and more communally focused and things like that? Why do people find that offensive?
I think perhaps because back in the 70s, when the second wave of feminism was getting going, I think there was a resistance to women even entering in the workplace at all, because they were seen as naturally suited to the home. And I think arguments about women being more nurturing and not suited to the corporate world were made with the intention of keeping women out of the workforce. So I can understand why there was resistance back then to those kinds of arguments. But I think now, several decades later, we can have a more nuanced discussion, and we can say, on the one hand, women should have all of the opportunities as men and discrimination is completely unacceptable. And we can acknowledge that women have achieved dominance and have achieved great things in all different kinds of fields, some which have been typically male-dominated. But at the same time, we can also acknowledge that on average, women tend towards having interests that do not overlap 100% with men. And I think we can acknowledge that, and we shouldn't be so scared that acknowledging that is going to somehow cause a backlash where women are suddenly run out of their corporate jobs. That's not going to happen.
Everyone could benefit from remaining open-minded, as, like you said, we're attempting to have more nuanced discussions about really polarizing topics because of the amount of information we're exposed to today and the amount of, at the rate we can share that information. We're learning so much. Our species is getting so smart right now. I feel like knowledge is exploding. We've got to kind of tread lightly and respectfully of one another. But, you know, also it's funny to me because when I hear something like, you know, men are more money hungry and status obsessed, I just, you said that a few minutes ago and it didn't even occur to me that that was mentioned until just now. But that's basically like a criticism of, not a negative criticism. I mean, you could, it sounds like a negative criticism, but point being, it didn't offend me. When I heard that, I was like, yeah, that makes sense. That's something that we should keep in mind in this discussion. And I think that that mentality produces positive conversation no matter where you find yourself.
It's really hard to have these conversations with people who have internalized these political ideas as part of their identity. So if you're criticizing or debating political ideas, it's like you're criticizing them as a person. And that's where a lot of discourse falls down. And, you know, we just can't seem to dialogue or communicate, I think, is when ideas are not separated out from moral components and identity components.
I wonder how much of that has to do with religion. Not that we're talking about religion, but I feel like religion and politics get kind of subconsciously tied together in a lot of people's minds, especially in places like America, where, you know, there's certain parts of the country that are super, super religious. And that part of the country is very different, politically speaking, is a totally different political charge there than other places in the country. And I think the world at large, too. So it's interesting to think about how religion might play into that to some extent. Have you found that at all?
Yeah, well, Australia is fairly secular. And I don't, in my everyday life, I don't come in contact with what you would call sort of conservative Christians or Orthodox religious people. But I have noticed that politics seems to be filling a bit of a void in some people's lives. You know, some people who are secular and perhaps atheists seem to be clinging on to politics as if it were a religion. I think once you get that sort of involved in political ideas, it can be very hard to have any kind of open-minded discussions because everything just becomes amplified to another level.
I think you're right. And actually, you're representing a side of the argument that I didn't even take into consideration, but and you're totally right about that. What I was getting at is more of these pockets of people that are so religious that their religion affects their political affiliation.
Yeah.
And especially with, I'm not going to name any names of religions specifically, but a lot of religions, when you look at what they're saying, they are quite misogynistic. And so you could see how it's not that crazy to think that religion could be fueling the fire to an extent.
Absolutely. Yeah. And when you are talking to very religious people, you can't criticize the religion because criticizing the religion is like a personal attack on them.
Totally.
And I think it's the ability to decouple ideas from you as a person, which allows rational discourse to happen. And I'm not saying that people who do that are always rational and aren't biased. We're all biased to some degree, but you definitely notice with religious people that that the bias becomes overwhelming and sort of nuanced rational discussions about ideas which are particular to that religion are just almost impossible.
So you were actually blacklisted in Australia for speaking out against feminism in this way, right?
I don't know if blacklisted is exactly the right word, but I had an experience where I was getting published in a local newspaper here and I wrote a blog post that was critical of some of the work that they were publishing about women and feminism. And there were two articles published about how research into evolutionary biology needed to be stopped because it was harmful to women. And another article about how social scientists have always been biased against women and are still biased against women. And I found them to be extremely prejudiced. And I just wrote a blog post sort of pointing out their logical flaws and that kind of thing. And then I was informed that I wasn't going to be getting published ever again at that newspaper.
Yeah, I mean, that's the definition of censorship.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's crazy. I think some people hear the word censorship and they think like conspiracy theory, Illuminati kind of like stuff. But it's actually more like, you know, these publications are all running on capitalism and certain ideas are just not popular with the masses yet. And so those of us who have unconventional ideas are forced to these like dark corners of the web to like build our own followings. And, you know, what's amazing is the internet has allowed us to do that. And a lot of us are creating these buzzworthy conversations and you've done that yourself. And it's just, it's amazing what you've just taken the high road and, you know, you've just chosen to do this yourself. And now you've got this huge following and it's awesome. It's awesome to see.
Yeah. No, I definitely think if an alternative is not complaining about stuff, it's just building your own club, building your own institution. And I sometimes look at a lot of the complaints about sexist industries or sexist spaces and I think, well, what's stopping people from building their own? I mean, there's always a creative solution rather than a destructive solution.
So what are some of the challenges that you see with the current feminism discussion that's happening?
Well, a lot of it seems to be based on this idea that the West is an oppressive patriarchy. The first criticism I have about that idea is that patriarchy sort of needs to be defined, and it's never really defined very clearly. If you look at the top of society, people in positions of power are predominantly men. But if you look at the bottom of society, homeless people, people who commit suicide, people in jail, people in very lowly paid blue-collar jobs, predominantly those individuals are male as well. So my first criticism of sort of what you would call orthodox feminist discourse is that if we live in a patriarchy, it's a hollow patriarchy. So there are men at the top, but there are men at the bottom. And most women sort of sit in the middle, in the averages. That's not to say that women don't commit suicide and women are not homeless, but overwhelmingly, the ratio is something like 4 men commit suicide to every 1 woman. So it's an overwhelmingly male condition to be at the bottom of society. The same goes when you look at prisons. So it's not that all men oppress all women. There are some very powerful men who control the capital and control power, but the majority of men don't share in that power and in that control. And so the resistance I have towards traditional or orthodox feminist discourse is that it seems to be a lot of professional middle-class women complaining about men as a class, whereas most men are not as well off and privileged as those professional middle-class feminists. I think feminism's first problem is that it collapses class into gender. And I don't think it explains society very well when you collapse class into gender, because it doesn't make sense that a professional woman, you know, a professional white woman with a media platform feels oppressed by her garbage collector, for example.
That's a good comparison. It's almost like what we should be discussing is, not to bring up religion again, but I think that's a huge contributor to this conversation. Mm-hmm. And class is a contributor as well. I think religion is a contributor in a very subconscious level for a lot of people, because even if I can't speak for Australia, but I know in America, even if you're unreligious, you're still operating on thousands of years of, first of all, Roman influence, and therefore Catholic influence, and therefore Jewish influence. And there is a lot of misogynistic ideas that are fueling these institutions. So it's not as simple as men at the top, like you're saying. You know, I'm with you. I think that's a really smart observation.
There is a lot of misogyny in old-fashioned ideas about women's behavior. Then there's so much control over female sexuality, which doesn't make sense anymore now that women have won the right to their self-determination, and then we also have contraception and things like that. But I think there's a lot of misogyny, but there's also it's not entirely, like, religious ideas about men and women are not entirely misogynistic. There's also an appreciation for the fragility of the family unit and vulnerability that women have in a time where before contraception existed. So I think it's a little more complicated than all religion is misogynistic. But I definitely grant that there are misogynistic threads, for sure.
What are some of the other problems that you see in these debates?
Well, the first one that I mentioned was that it's often the arguments or the narrative is very simplistic, and a gender's disparity is attributed almost solely to sexism, when there are other more important factors, such as women have children, and it's really, really hard to have young babies and toddlers at home and then work full time. It's exhausting. It's just really difficult. And so the fact that women still bear children, I think that is acknowledged much less than sexism and patriarchy, when it's so much more important when you're talking about things like women's lack of representation in certain fields, or the gender pay gap, for example. It just boggles my mind that a lot of people think that the pay gap is due to sexism and not having children. Because it's just, it defies common sense.
Interesting.
And then there's another criticism, which I guess is a little bit more complex, and that is this notion of human nature being a blank slate. So there's this book that was written by Steven Pinker back in the year 2000 called The Blank Slate. And in it, he sort of debunks and goes through all of the philosophical arguments for this idea that this extremely popular idea that human beings are born as blank slates, and then who they are, who they become, is entirely influenced by culture. So that idea, that concept has been challenged and discredited by research in psychology, behavioral genetics, evolutionary biology, a range of different fields. And so we know now that men and women have, while we have a lot of overlap in our psychology, there are some important differences, and that those differences are not entirely shaped by culture. They're born in us.
They're genetic, you mean? Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, well, I suppose it's passed down through DNA, but they're just, they're the result of natural and sexual selection. So
right.
A most obvious example is sexuality. So men and women on average tend to express their sexuality differently. And some people make the argument that that's all because of the media. You know, if you grow up watching movies and seeing advertising and that kind of thing, and you receive all of these messages from society, that makes men want to be more promiscuous and women less. But evolutionary psychologists will say that no, there are more fundamental reasons for the differences, and they go back to problems that had to be solved over deep evolutionary time. So the important thing to remember in these discussions is that most problems that men and women have faced over time have been the same, but there are a few key different ones, and many of them are revolve around reproduction and caring for children and that kind of thing. So when we can't acknowledge that there is any kind of intrinsic predisposition for women to want to look after their own babies or want to take some time off so they have enough energy to look after their toddlers, if we can't acknowledge things like that, we just get stuck at this sort of stalemate where any differences between the behavior of men and women has to be blamed on culture and society. And no matter how much we try and make things fair and equal, these differences still seem to arise. So we just get stuck in this stalemate where we don't understand what's going on.
It seems like there's this huge groundswell for uniformity right now in so many different political discussions. It's not just sexism, but it's like there's all these different debates that are happening right now, which I actually feel are good debates, good discussions that need to happen. But what frightens me a little bit is how uncomfortable people are with their differences. It's like people are they're not acknowledging the fact that we've all evolved in different parts of the world, to different climates, to different terrains, different lifestyles, different diets.
Yeah.
There's this huge movement towards uniformity. Everybody just wants to be the same, but we're not the same. We're all different, and we need to like embrace our differences if we're going to have balance, I think. I think technology is allowing there to be a certain amount of uniformity with our rights and with what we can do with our energy. And yeah, that's beautiful. But us fighting about our biological differences is not going to get us anywhere.
That's right. And it's the basis of tolerance, accepting that there are differences. Like, tolerance isn't making everyone the same. That's oppressive. You know, accepting that each individual is different and has different wants, desires, and life aspirations. I mean, that's the whole basis of being, of having a tolerant attitude, and respecting differences even when you disagree with them. You know, I think that's something that we're losing really rapidly. Like, people are allowed to do things that you disagree with, and that's okay.
Right. There's got to be grace We all have to acknowledge that we're going to be different and that that's a beautiful thing. You know, life,
yeah.
Diversity is the foundation of any life form. You know, you look at anything on a molecular level and it thrives on diversity. If we get too homogenous, we're gonna be susceptible to all sorts of things that we don't even know about yet. There's gonna be a whole other can of worms we're gonna be opening.
Absolutely. Diversity, and being exposed to new and different ideas, it's like strengthening your immune system by being exposed to different bacteria and viruses. I mean, some of them might be bad, but at least you're being exposed to them and learning how to counter them.
This is actually my new diet I'm on right now. It's called the diversity diet. I eat anything possible. This is a real thing I'm trying. We'll see how long I live. But people think I'm crazy because, you know, in California, especially, everybody's gluten-free and they have all these dietary restrictions. And I've done all of them myself. I've tried pretty much every diet you can try. And we're obviously not here to talk about diet, but we're talking about diversity. And I think that diversity is, it always makes any system stronger.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, there's this trend at the moment to talk up diversity, but in a really limited manner. So, you know, you've heard of this idea of diversity in, you know, skin color and genitalia, but not diversity of thought.
Interesting. Yeah.
So we have to have both.
I agree with that 100%.
Yeah.
I want to go back to something you said earlier, and we can put a pin here if you want, but I want to address this before it skips my mind. We were talking about religion, and you said that religion isn't misogynistic intrinsically, and I'm not convinced that it is either, but just for the sake of conversation, because I think religion is a huge piece to this, I think it's worth exploring that thought, because in my mind, the only real religion is monotheism, not in terms of credibility, but in terms of like a systematic order that keeps people in line. It's really like the monotheistic religions that are really restrictive.
Yeah.
And those were a direct product of agriculture and the origins of civilization, which were, this gets into some potentially controversial territory, but, you know, the origins of civilization were not fair towards women. And that's what, where a lot of these sensitivities lie. I think it's in our evolution. It's not just cultural. It's like, we're sensitive to these things because it's a part of our heritage to a certain extent. So, I don't think it's that crazy that monotheism is intrinsically misogynist because, it was not really fair for a lot of women for a long time.
Yeah. And back when, thousands of years ago when agriculture was first invented, I think it was the first time that men could really, the powerful men that amassed resources and monopolized resources, I think it was the start of very powerful men being able to monopolize women in their communities. So having polygamous marriage and sort of having harems where they would have many, many wives and women were just basically thought of as property.
Right.
Yeah. And I think there's debate about whether or not that started with agriculture or, we were basically moderately monogamous before agriculture. I think some people argue that polygamy coincided with men being able to amass a lot of resources through agriculture.
That's an interesting point, which I haven't heard argued before. But you could also say, take the Old Testament, for example.
Yeah.
You know, there's tons of polygamy in the first few books of the Old Testament, but it slowly starts to die out towards the end of the Old Testament. And this is, this is directly in line with the idea that monotheism and monogamy are the same product, basically.
Yeah.
So it's, because monotheism basically took polytheistic tradition and tried to monopolize it and sell it to people as a product and as a means of control. And so it makes sense that, that humans were not monogamous like the majority of the rest of the animal kingdom up until civilization started, and then it slowly started to die out.
Yeah, and I think the evolution of all of these behaviors is complicated, but I think it's interesting to look at what function it might have served. So in terms of both monogamy and religion, what was the function that monotheistic religion served? Was it more stabilizing? Did it create more stable tribes that were able to grow and expand and beat other tribes? It might have been the case. So I think
that's a good argument. Maybe it's a good system, maybe.
Well, maybe not for the individuals involved, but
agreed. But for world domination at large, it's excellent.
Yeah. There's different levels of analysis. So if you're looking at the survival of a tribe, what is good for the survival of a tribe might not be good for the individual members of that tribe.
Right.
That makes sense.
What are some other contributors to this debate besides religion in your mind?
Well, I've just finished reviewing a book called The Rise of Victimhood Culture. And it's a book written by two sociologists called Bradley Campbell and Jason Manning. And they look at things like microaggressions, safe spaces, trigger warnings, and that kind of thing. And they're moral psychologists, so they want to try and understand what all of these new behaviors and practices are about. And they theorize that there is a new moral culture developing, and it's coming from the universities. It's coming from elite colleges in America in particular. And so this book identifies different trends and different behaviors that have been sort of emerging and growing stronger and then spreading out into the mainstream. And one of those trends is basically to identify victims according to their group membership and then basically deferring to victims for everything. So because women have historically been marginalized and, you know, have had fewer opportunities than men, we are now often seen as victims or in terms of a victim group. And, you know, for better or worse, I personally think for worse, because we're not, I don't think it's helpful to view people as victims all the time.
I agree.
But there are other groups as well who are considered victim groups. So part of their analysis is looking at how victims groups are sort of awarded status, protected, sometimes viciously protected, and then any kind of harm or trauma, the definition of harm and trauma keeps expanding. So things that were never considered harmful in the past, such as a political debate or disagreement, are now interpreted as harmful. This has major consequences for how a university operates. If you can't have debate about ideas, you know, it's difficult to run a university properly. But there is this idea that victims and victim groups need to be fiercely protected at all costs. And so now we have these ideas like words can be violence. We have these ideas about harm such as microaggressions. So you might say something that you didn't mean to be racist, but if it's interpreted that way, then it's you're guilty of an aggressive gesture.
In other words, it's all in the mind of the person, the interpreter.
That's right, yeah.
And that sounds like some 1984 material.
Absolutely. And how can you can't alter your behavior if you don't know what's going to be interpreted as offensive or aggressive. It's really, and if we accept that intention doesn't matter, then you're basically saying one group of people who are protected have all of this power over another group of people who aren't protected. Because I think the important thing to remember about microaggressions is that it's not a two-way street. Only a victim group can receive a microaggression. So, like, you can be microaggressive against me because you're a guy and I'm a woman, but I can't I can't be microaggressive against you. It's this idea that there's no such thing as reverse sexism or reverse racism. It's, I think it's very dangerous because it gives people a lot of power. Like if things are not reciprocal, you know, if you can be aggressive against me and I can't be aggressive against you, that gives me a lot of power over you.
You know, if we continue down this road, we're going to create a society of people who are all walking on eggshells around each other. And this is, you know, first of all, we don't need to go into the psychological effects of walking on eggshells with someone because everybody is familiar with them. But even just evolutionarily, you know, the mammalian instincts that we have, the desire to be pack animals, the desire for community, it works against all of these things in us. And so if we create this culture of people that cannot talk to each other, that are just afraid to say anything of value to each other, to afraid to open their mouths and that they might like say something offensive, like if that's how we're looking at every conversation we're having with people in our everyday life, we are going to be miserable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think the really dangerous space is the workplace.
I agree.
We can always find friends who we get along with really well and we share all of the same ideas, political and religious or whatever. But in the workplace, we have to work with people who we don't necessarily agree with about everything, and we have to find a way to be polite. And if, you know, and there's also legislation that protects against things like discrimination and harassment in the workplace. So if the young people that are in universities now are going to graduate and then enter into professional workplaces, and things like looking at someone for a couple of seconds too long is considered sexual harassment, I mean, we're going to be in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
There's going to be a lot of lawsuits and a lot of basically complaints. Because one of the things these sociologists identify in their book about victimhood culture is that the ideas of harm and trauma keep expanding, and this idea of offensiveness and aggressiveness keeps sort of like expanding. But the other trend, which is really unique to this new moral culture, is complaining to third parties and complaining to authority figures. So within the universe,
to the person who offended you, you go to somebody else and gossip.
Exactly. So in the university environment, it's going to like an administrator and complaining about another student. In the workplace setting, it will be someone, your colleague says something that you don't like or you find offensive, and so it's going to your boss and telling your boss to get that other person fired.
Yeah, that's really scary because you can't, what you're essentially doing is you're going in with yin and you're not giving the yang any chance to, you know, balance things out. If you're going directly to a third party, if you don't go to the person who's offended you first and try to talk to them first, if that person doesn't listen to you, or at that point you find out that that person is full of shit for some reason, then go to the third party and have that person ejected for some reason. But you know, if you don't go to the person, first of all, you're not practicing your own communication skills. You're not giving that person the chance to tell you what they really meant, because even if you speak the same language, you can grow up in different parts of the country or different parts of the world even, and you may not even know. People use words differently all the time. So I think it's like you've got to give that person the benefit of the doubt and
absolutely,
before you go to that third party.
And you get this situation where it's a prisoner's dilemma. So I can't remember the university it was, but I did see it, a situation where a guy and a girl, university students, got drunk and they hooked up together. And the next morning, the guy went and made a complaint about being too intoxicated to consent, because he thought that the girl was going to do that. And so he went and made the complaint before she could.
Wait, I'm confused. So he got drunk and had sex with this girl and then complained about what?
Oh, they both got drunk.
They both got drunk.
And they had, they hooked up. The guy was petrified the next day that the girl was going to make a complaint about sexual assault.
I see. So he preemptively jumped the gun. He beat her to the punch. That's really scary.
Yeah, I know. And so, I think we can expect more of that kind of thing to start happening. People are going to be scared.
Well, I hope not.
Yeah, I hope not.
How do we fight it? What do you think we do to fight that?
Not be so sensitive and not take everything so personally. Mm-hmm. I mean, I spend a lot of time on Twitter and people say mean things to me, and I just turn the computer off and just walk away. I just try and remember that it's not real.
Right. Everybody, anything anyone says is their people's words are a projection of what's going on inside their minds. You shouldn't take compliments personally. You shouldn't take offensive, criticisms personally. You shouldn't almost take anything personally. You should just be, I think. I think if more people were comfortable just being in a meditative state when they're, in conversation and they're listening and just like, that's interesting. Just let it roll off your back. You don't have to take everything so personally.
That's right. And at the end of the day, words are just words. It's not the same as having your physical safety threatened.
I agree with that. I think you're right about that. Yeah, it is different.
Yeah. I think there's a line between words and physical violence, and we've got to be really clear about where that line is. And physical violence is really, is really bad, and we always want to prevent any kind of arguments from escalating into violence. But part of that is being allowed to talk and being allowed to disagree, even have heated disagreements, without it ever crossing that line.
Yeah, and we've got to be able to agree to disagree and, be able to have a conversation and walk away with nothing lost, nothing gained, just listen.
That's right. Yeah, and also just being able to walk away. We don't have to win every argument. We don't have to convince everyone to see our point of view. Being able to walk away, it's really important.
Well, we've talked about a lot of things. We've talked about feminism. We've talked about we've talked about sexism. We've talked about racism. We've talked about just about every kind of disagreement you could cover.
Yeah.
But I guess the common theme here is open-mindedness and diversity, being willing to have conversations with people you may not agree with, and for that to be okay. But I do think there comes a point where if you're with someone, if it's a broken record, if there's someone you're having the same problem with over and over again, you've got to draw a hard boundary. But it doesn't have to be malicious. You can say, I'm sorry, it's probably better for us not to talk. We need some distance. Yeah. You don't have to go get the person fired unless they've done something physically to you and you're in harm's way or something. But yeah, I think everything you're saying is right. And it's, I really hope that conversations like this will help encourage people to just lighten up a little bit and not take things so seriously.
Yeah, I hope so too. I really hope so too. Well, it's been really fun chatting.
Yeah, same to you. Same to you, Claire. Thanks for making the time. I want to encourage all the listeners to check out Quillette, Quillette.com. It's an awesome publication. And Claire, you've just done a wonderful job. I love the conversations you're sparking, and I hope we speak again soon.
Yeah, thanks. Cheers.
What do you think about diversity, microaggressions, safe places, all these buzzwords we've been throwing around today? I want to hear your thoughts, because that's what this is all about. This is a conversation, not a monologue. And if you're watching on YouTube, that's a great place to join in. You can leave a comment there. CastBox also has a comment section. Apple Podcasts, not so much. Regardless of your platform of choice, be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. That way your phone will always stay up to date. You don't have to remember to download an episode. The robots will do it for you. If you want to send me an email, I would love to hear from you. You can send that to hello@spellboundshow.com. I'm Julian Smith. This has been Spellbound. I'm loving making the show. This is just the most rewarding thing I think I've ever done, and I hope you guys are getting as much out of this as I am. I can't wait to dig back in next week. I hope you guys will join me. We're talking to Dan Harris. I'm super excited to have him on this show because he's such a badass. Sorry for swearing. I try not to do it too much, but sometimes I get so excited. Dan Harris is an ABC News correspondent and anchor and co-host of numerous other news shows. He's also the author of 10% Happier, which is also now a podcast and an app. And I'm super excited to have him on because I read his book a couple years ago and I just love what he's doing. And he's been so kind to grace us with his presence. So check back next week. You don't want to miss that. I can't wait. Hope to see you there. Take care. Definitely signing off now. Wow, I'm still talking. I can't believe it.